Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I don't know if it's snowing where you are, but in Falmouth, the snow is so beautiful. Do you have snow or rain out there in Harwich?
Out here we just have, it doesn't know what it is. It's sort of like sleety terribleness.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, because it is just beautiful outside this morning here.
It's not a winter wonderland here.
Well, we've got the winter wonderland, which, of course, we love to see a little before Christmas. And Christmas, of course, December, the Christmas bird count coming up. What changes are we seeing because of the pandemic?
Yes, birding in a pandemic. I mean, you know, birding is obviously a pretty safe thing. I think we know more and more, if you're paying attention, that what we need to not be doing is hanging out indoors together. And so hang out outdoors together, go birding. And a Christmas bird count is a good way to do that if you just follow basic, you know, common sense things like not hopping in, you know, hopping into cars with people that are outside your pod and that kind of thing, or being too close to each other. But the main difference is we're not having that social event at the end of the day, and that's a bummer, just like every other party that's not happening these days. But normally one of the most fun aspects of a Christmas bird count is coming together at the end of the day, you know, over some hot chili and whatever else, and with a rare bird in your back pocket that you're not talking about until it's the right time and that kind of thing. And hearing what everyone else saw, you know, knowing the final tally, what the rare birds were and that kind of thing. It's, you know, sharing your experiences. And so obviously we can't do that. And so people will be doing just basically emailing their lists and that sort of thing. It'll be a little bit more impersonal, but there's no reason for the counts not to go forward as usual, because it's a very safe activity. And a lot of people are birding alone or with someone in their household, or, you know, you can just be in your own car. So they're going forward. And another thing is owling. Some of us go out in the wee hours in the morning,
right.
I guess would technically be against the curfew, but I don't think it's, that's certainly not the intention.
I don't think I'm really looking for you in the woods there, yeah.
No,
listening
no.
For owls.
People alone on a country road owling at 4 a.m. is not a COVID risk and probably not going to set off any alarms regarding the curfew.
Right. But, you know, couldn't you still get together like on a Zoom at the end and have those, you know, those little surprises in your back pocket?
I just think it would be difficult for everybody to get back to their respective places,
right,
where they could get on a computer and you're exhausted and, you
and
know,
zoomed out anyway, right?
Yeah, and people are traveling locally. You know, you know, a lot of the Cape counts, people come off Cape for the day. It's not like you can go, I'll just go sit in an internet cafe, you know.
That's right. You can't do that either, right? So the counts will still happen, and more than likely, though, it's going to be the people who usually do the counts, not so much new people this year, right?
I think, I don't see why not. I think the islands have a difficult situation because they rely so heavily on people coming from off island, and they have to be careful about that. I think they'll probably just mostly use their local folks this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, Nantucket in particular really depends on a lot of really good birders that come in from off island. But they have a lot of good birders on the island. I think they'll be fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think people traveling for the day within Massachusetts is a big deal, because you're just going to be outside the whole time and
right,
in your car.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the tallies are this year, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I expect there'll be, you know, as usual. But, there's some interesting birds around, certainly, as always. We're getting into this is the season where rare birds start showing up at feeders. I think we'll talk about that at some point.
Yeah, we're going to give 866-999-4626 for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you've been getting reports of lingering Baltimore Orioles at feeders. I mean, how unusual is that?
Not unusual at all.
Not, okay.
Anymore. I haven't looked at the historical data, and it's tough because there are so many people able to report what they're seeing. Like, people you never would have heard from 20 or 30 years ago are on Facebook groups posting what they're seeing at their feeders. And so I think we know more now. We're flushing out more of these birds than we used to in the past, so it's hard to look at trends. But yeah, the people are getting like 2, 3, 4 Baltimore Orioles at their feet.
Wow.
Times I've been getting reports lately, typically one, and not common. I mean, this isn't a thing like, you know, every other house has a Baltimore Oriole. It's still rare, but some number of them, for some reason, will stay locally, especially places like East Ham and Orleans tend to be very popular with the Orioles in the winter for some reason. There's a lot of fruit, a lot of persistent fruit in the thickets and a lot of cedars. And so they can do pretty well with that, and they will come to feeders, sometimes even seed feeders, especially if you have the good stuff, the hulled sunflower seeds, but suet, but mostly not, you know, coming to feeders so much. But if you, like on a Christmas bird count, one year I had, it was Jeremiah Trimble and I had 11 Baltimore Orioles in, you know, it was like December 19th or something like that, in one neighborhood in East Orleans.
Wow.
And so it's amazing what we'll try to hang on here where, you know, we have a kind of slightly warmer winter climate here. We don't tend to have snow cover. We have lots and lots of wet thickets full of persistent fruits that birds that are going to make a go of it can survive off of. And so especially as it gets snowy elsewhere, I think we're getting more birds like that now. So they get pushed to the coast, and things just get better as the winter goes on here.
Yeah, and you had a rare hummingbird visiting a feeder in Orleans? Tell us about that.
Yeah, boy, I've got a breaking news rare bird that I'll, I'll get to in a minute, but it's getting hard to keep up. But yeah, you know, I'm always telling people, leave up your hummingbird feeders. It always comes up. Should I take it down? You know, if I don't take it down, will the ruby-throated hummingbird forget to migrate? And it doesn't work that way. They leave, and then if you leave them up, you have a chance of getting a rare one that, by some chance, for some reason, ended up here. And some very small number of Western species of hummingbirds will fly the wrong way or get blown or something happens, and they end up flying this way, and so they'll end up in coastal places. And so the Cape, in any given winter, will end up with one or two rufous hummingbirds, usually. Occasionally some of the other species. And a rufous hummingbird, indeed, turned up in South Orleans, and somebody left their feeder up purposely in case something showed up. And sure enough, they got one. And it was banded and determined to be a rufous hummingbird. So this is a West Coast bird of the mountains. It breeds up into southern Alaska, coastal Alaska. So they're not, like, this weather is not foreign to these birds. It's not like, I mean, it's pretty cold and wet when they're starting their breeding season. So, you know, they're not made of glass, and they can survive cold temperatures and as long as there's some food, like a feeder. But
yeah.
But they should be in western Mexico right now.
Holy cow. You know, it's so funny because we look at these tiny little hummingbirds and we think they're so fragile, and they're really tough little guys, aren't they?
Yeah. If you look at hummingbirds broadly, and the biggest diversity of them is in cooler mountains throughout Central and South America, where there's just mind-blowing numbers of species of hummingbirds. And they occur up to these very high elevations where it's not necessarily snowing, but it, you know, pretty cool. So they're not necessarily, they don't need it to be hot, you know. They're not like all tropical jungle kind of birds. So yeah, people worry about them, but if they have food provided for them, they can actually gain weight in this weather around here.
Wow. Right, and a Western tanager?
Yeah.
Rooster?
Yeah. So Western tanager is the name would apply. People are probably familiar with the scarlet tanager, which is just an absolutely gorgeous local bird of our kind of more mature forests with the deciduous component around here, sometimes pine forest. But and this is a very different-looking Western version. A male is like, looks like a giant goldfinch with a red face. So it's a pretty interesting looking bird. And the ones that turn up here tend to be more subtly plumaged female birds. So it's like yellowish with dark wings with two white wing bars. And a bit like a kind of a big bill, not quite cardinal size bill. But there's one showing up at a feeder in Brewster right now. And so I've noticed this trend. Maybe this is a plug for Mike O'Connor there at the Birdwatcher General Store. People, I'm not being paid off, I swear. But people who put out the premium seed, the stuff that helps pad Mike's offshore bank accounts, the hulled sunflower seeds, that's where rare, for some reason, tanagers in particular, and tanagers are not a feeder bird. You don't see scarlet tanagers at people's feeders, except very rarely, at like an orange or something that people have put out for Orioles. But there have been numerous examples I can think of summer tanagers and western tanagers that end up here in late fall and winter, and they tend to be at a house where they're putting out the expensive hulled sunflower seeds. So I don't know, tanagers are lazy or something. They don't know how to open the regular sunflower seeds like a chickadee does. So they end up at the bistro houses that are putting out the premium food.
That's funny. So this is actually really a good time to keep your eye, if you have feeders, to keep your eye on them, especially in the areas now where we've got some snow, right? Because they may not be, you know, everything's snow covered, or at least for now. They'll be more apt to visit your feeders, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like I was saying earlier, it could get better as things are pushed to the coast by bad weather inland. We've gotten some snow inland just recently, and that can push all kinds of things to the coast. As things freeze further north, the ducks come this way, and so by midwinter, the ducks are probably better than they are now. And same thing with songbirds, including rare stuff that ended up here somehow, could get pushed to the coast, and they'll have a better chance of surviving here because a little bit warmer, a little bit more likely to have open water, which is a pretty important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, even when things are pretty frozen here, there's some moving water at the upper reaches of a marsh where birds can get fresh water. And so it's just a little easier for things to tough it out here on the Cape, why we get such good birds.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's bird news. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So Megan in Sandwich sent us a note and some photos. She and her five-year-old daughter, I guess, were out walking, and her five-year-old daughter spotted this dead bird on the side of the street, and she took some photos. And it's sad. It's a little dovekie, right?
Yes. And so I talked about these a couple of weeks ago on one of the weekly bird reports because there had been a big flight of them over the course of a couple of days. And East Ham, which is a traditional spot to see big flights of them just after storms, and also Race Point with thousands of them. And so sometimes when that happens, they end up blown inland where they will end up in driveways and parking lots, you know, thinking they're water, or they just end up there. And since then, just over this past weekend, there was another big dovekie event where folks on Sunday morning saw thousands of them at First Encounter in East Ham. And that's just First Encounter is a place that because of where it is, after a nor'easter or some kind of easterly storm goes by and then the winds are strong northwest, it bunches up all the seabirds that are trying to get out of Cape Cod Bay up against the beach at First Encounter. Mm-hmm. Sort of the bay side, the inner elbow of the Cape. And so thousands went by there, and the folks who were seeing them said they were like sometimes behind them. They were like, the dovekies were seen inland, like flying over the middle part of the Cape, going from the bayside to the ocean side. I can't think of that happening. People were finding them on ponds on the Cape Cod waterfowl census on Sunday. There were a dovekie on a pond I don't know if there's many modern records of that here on the Cape, but there are probably 7 or 8 different dovekies were found on freshwater ponds. This is an offshore seabird that should mainly winters around Arctic pack ice, at the edges of pack ice where they feed on zooplankton. They're like a little black and white miniature Nerf football. Really just adorable seabirds. And so, like you said, sometimes people are finding them dead. Some people have found live ones and gotten them to WildCare, so there's some good stories too. And I know WildCare has at least 5 right now that are doing well. Force feeding them their patented slurries, keeping them alive. They do a really good job with seabirds there. They know what they're doing. So if you do find one, you know, that event has passed, but there could be others. I mean, we could be seeing dovekies with every time we get an easterly blow followed by northwest winds. And so, you know, look them up, get a sense of what they look like, and maybe you'll find one in your driveway or on a road or something. But they're a favorite bird of a lot of birders. And
yeah.
If you saw one, you'd see why. 2 of them showed up at this pond where my wife and I got married in Sandwich at Camp Burgess, this little pond there. You know, it's a YMCA camp, and there's these 2 dovekies.
That's funny.
Of Greenland and the pack ice, just like little tiny rubber duckies with no necks, black and white, just paddling around there in spectacle ponds. Just very unusual, kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, very cute. Let's talk to Kim, who's giving us a call from South Yarmouth. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a kind of a generic question for Mark.
Sure.
How do you tell male and female blue jays? They all look the same to me.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. you might be able to do it with a black light. I don't know. So there's blue jays can tell, but we can't. And the reason is that they can see in the ultraviolet spectrum. And apparently there are plumage differences between the males and females in the ultraviolet spectrum, is my understanding. And so, we don't know. It's their secret.
But, yeah, that's a good question, Kim. They look exactly the same, don't they?
They do, and I've always wondered. I have one other quick question for you.
Sure.
A few years ago when we had that very cold, like, 6-week snap of really intense cold and snow, I finally had 3 bluebirds show up at my feeder. And I also had at that time a robin that had kind of staked out the territory and let all the other birds in. But when the bluebirds tried to come in and eat, he attacked them.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if there's a beef between bluebirds and robins.
Yeah. Well, not typically, but yeah, in harsh conditions like that, if resources get really scarce, both of them are fruit eaters. They're hardy songbirds that can winter in pretty high northern latitudes here where there are bad winters because they can eat fruit. Some of these persistent fruits like winterberry, ornamental crab apples are actually really good for them and are good overall for wildlife. And then there's some invasive stuff that they can take advantage of, like multiflora rose and bittersweet. But things like mockingbirds are very pugnacious. They don't move around like those other ones do. So even in normal conditions, a mockingbird will be chasing away robins and bluebirds from their little fruit thicket that they're defending. But the frugivores, normally there's enough for everybody, the waxwings, the robins, the bluebirds, the starlings get in there, and you'll see starlings covering the cedars sometimes this time of year, eating all the fruits too. Things will get ugly if things get scarce and conditions get harsh.
Yeah. Kim, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. John is calling from Orleans. Hi, John.
Hi. Question. Have songbird populations declined very sharply recently? When did it begin, and what effective is being done to reverse it, or what should be done? Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I didn't know if that was going to turn into I'm not seeing the birds at my feeders right now question, which is very common and has happened to me several times this fall. But I'm not sure what scale. I guess at the continent scale, there was that big study that got a lot of press several months back, pre-pandemic, you know, that other world we used to live in, and showing that songbirds had declined in numbers by some, I need to look it up again, some really eye-popping, 30% or something like that. Millions and millions of individual birds were estimated to have been lost over the last 40 years or so, based on a combination of data, including radar data, NEXRAD radar data, where you can get an estimate of the mass of birds flying during migration events. So they looked at that over time series and some other, you know, data from breeding bird surveys and things like that. And it's kind of an interesting study when you get into the weeds on it and look at it species by species. Like, a lot of the decline was things like starlings and house sparrows, which we don't really, I don't want to say we don't care that they're declining. We want to look at why they're declining and why it might, how that might affect other birds. But yeah, over the long term, there has certainly been a decline in a number of species.
Yeah, John's asking what you can do about it, but there's lots of reasons. You got cats, you got buildings that, you know, are in the way of bird flight, you got loss of habitat. I mean, there's really a lot of things going on here, right?
Right, and it gets overwhelming as an individual. And one thing I like to talk about, you know, those of us who are lucky enough to own houses and have some property that we manage, you know, our little quarter acre, third of an acre, half an acre, whatever it is, our little kingdoms, we can do things. And if more and more people are managing their properties in a way that benefits wildlife, and that includes everything from keeping your cats indoors to plants you choose for landscaping, leaving the native plants, adding more native plants, thinking about fruit and flowers for songbirds and insects, native plants for the herbivorous insects that the birds eat, kind of thinking holistically about your property and skipping the pesticides and things like that, not buying neonicotinoid pesticides, which are still widely available in your local garden centers, those systemic pesticides that impact birds and bees negatively. So, you know, educating yourself about all of that kind of stuff. We can all do those things at the individual level, but, you know, larger scale, supporting, you know, organizations that purchase and protect land, that kind of thing. I mean,
yeah, so there's a lot you can do.
Most of the focus is on climate change anymore, and that's sort of this overarching thing that touches everything. And we don't really know some of the effects of that on individual species. It's sort of complicated, but really, on shorter timescales, it's still the old basics of habitat loss and, you know, mortality from things like cats and, you know, industry and things like that, deforestation in the tropics. The same things that we were talking about in the 80s and 90s are still big problems today, even though, you know, climate change sort of gets most of the oxygen, but it's all part of the picture.
Part of it, yeah.
And so addressing those things is really important.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Let's talk to Tim, who's calling from Nantucket. Hi, Tim.
Hey, glad to be on. This is a real treat.
Great. Go ahead.
I have a couple of comments, and one actually is, this wasn't going to be the reason I called, but, you know, the deforestation concept is growing on Nantucket more because a normal method, if someone buys a lot or gets either private or commercial, is they effectively clear cut the entire lot. there's no attempt to maintain habitat or selectively build, and it's really, it's not consistent with how Nantucket did things till recently, and I just wanted to make that comment. But the other comment, going back to when Mark was talking about the Christmas count in Nantucket and people who might or might not come over, you know, day trippers, as you've probably seen on the Cape and the Vineyard as well, and in any other, you know, second home enclave, we've had hundreds of people and families come as what are called COVID refugees. And so they might make up the balance and fill in for the people who may not come over. And a lot of these people, you know, demographically and financially are well involved in all of the groups over here that would be involved in birding and habitat, like the Conservation Foundation, Mariah Mitchell. So
yeah, good
that,
point.
That may be what's going to happen, and I hope it does.
Your
show is making me very wistful.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, there's a good community of local birders there, certainly. But some of the people that typically come over are among the best birders in the Northeast. Hard to replace that kind of talent, but there's good talent locally. I mean, people come from Connecticut, and it's a big draw that counts. And I want to be clear, I don't really know what the plans are this year. And I haven't spoken to, like, Edie Ray or anybody. I don't know who's doing the count or not. I just suspected that not as many people would be coming over because of COVID and because of the travel involved and that sort of thing.
Let's hope you're right. There's enough folks who are birding there that'll help Edie Ray and the rest of those folks get a good count. Thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Kathy's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I was at Long Pond Sunday morning at 7:15 in Falmouth and saw what I'm quite certain were three juvenile bald eagles. Has anyone else reported them?
Where again in Falmouth did you say?
Long Pond
Reservoir.
Long Pond?
Yep.
Yes.
I don't know about that so much as a site, but they're generally around. And especially in winter, that's always been the easiest season to see bald eagles. But now, as the population has skyrocketed over the last 20 years, and now they're breeding on the Cape very, very sparsely, at least one pair successfully, we know, probably others. And so they are a year-round presence here on the Cape. It's been true for many years that you could see juvenile bald eagles at, you know, just about any time of year, kind of rarely. But now they're just around. And Falmouth is one of the places where there may be a breeding pair, Falmouth, Mashpee, Sandwich, that kind of general area. There's probably a breeding pair or two that we're not aware of the nest. But it's always a treat to see them. You know, you're not seeing them every day. But I can go to Long Pond here in Harwich, a few minutes from my house, and I have a better than 50% chance of seeing a bald eagle there just about any time I go, this time of year in particular. And it's been great. I mean, it's a conservation success story, and more people are getting to see bald eagles. And if you're not following it, you're like, whoa, bald eagle, that doing here?
Kathy, lucky you, and thanks for sharing that. I walk at Long Pond, too. I'm going to keep my eyes open when I go again.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that there were reports of a nesting pair at Mashpee-Wakeby Pond, you know, and there had been sightings, but I had never seen three juveniles all at once up in the air, and it was pretty awesome.
Wow.
So thank you.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Kathy. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned the Cape Cod waterfowl census. Tell us a little bit about that. What did they find? Do we know? Do you have the tally of that yet?
It takes a while to input the results, though. One of our volunteer board members at Cape Cod Bird Club, MJ Fody, has kind of taken that over and really revamped it. So we've got really good coverage this year. A lot of people have already entered their data, even though it was just this past Saturday and Sunday. I'm sure everybody went out on Sunday because Saturday was washout. But so this was started back in 1983. Blair Nicola and the Cape Cod Bird Club back then started this effort to count ducks on the freshwater bodies of the Cape, and there's some ridiculous number of 900. I don't know what the estimated total is of freshwater ponds, water bodies of various kinds on the Cape, mostly kettle ponds. But, you know, because of what we are, people tend to focus on saltwater, seabirds, marshes, shorebirds, that kind of thing. And so this was an effort to survey the pretty good diversity of freshwater ducks that winter here, again, because we tend to have open water when north and west of us it has frozen at a certain point in the winter. And it's the first weekend in December, and that feels too early, increasingly, you know, like haven't had a chance for that deep freeze inland to push all the ducks here. And so volunteers just sort of fan out, and you have your group of ponds that you're responsible for, and you have 2 days to cover them. It's just a fun way to reason to get out and bird all day. You know, we're all those birders. Yeah. We're just looking for excuses. Well, I got to go do the waterfall census, honey.
I'll see you later.
You're on your own. Yeah. We're looking for excuses to get out there. And you never know what you're going to find. Like this year, because of that storm, there were seabirds on the freshwater, on the quiet little freshwater ponds. Like I saw eiders, scoters, red-throated loon, and razorbill on these two ponds.
Wow!
And none of, you know, especially the eider and the razorbill. Those are not things that you would find on a freshwater pond. But the weather was the wind was so strong this weekend. Even the seabirds didn't want to be on the sea. It was just they're like, I'm taking. Taking a break.
Gotta
here.
Sit over here, yeah, where I won't get so blown around.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Joan, who's giving us a call from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I have two mourning doves. One is running around without a tail. He just arrived, or she. Boy. But there's been a mourning dove here since April, with a lump on the back of it, on the nape of its neck. What could that be?
I don't know. There's various ailments and abscesses that, you know, things that birds can get. I'm not an expert in the bird diseases. The banders tend to be, bird banders tend to be more up on that stuff because they handle birds and they see these things up close. But just like with any organisms, there's a variety of ailments they can get. And it sounds like it's not something that's impacting survival, you know, as long as it can eat. It's surprising what wild birds can live with in terms of maladies, as long as they can get enough food into themselves. And so I'm not sure exactly what that would be.
Right. First, I thought it was just the feathers, you know, the molt and everything. But no, this has been going on since, as I said, April. It's on the back of the neck, the nape of the neck, it's not impeding its eating or anything like that, and it seems to be doing fine.
Oh. Yeah. So if there's a bander or a bird vet listening or someone who's like,
know
what it is, maybe they could call in or email in or something.
Yeah. Joan, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got a couple of emails. Sandria says, when watching my bird feeder, how do I do the count when it appears that the same birds return over and over again?
I struggle with that. It's very difficult to count, especially certain birds at feeders. And you know, like everybody else, I'm spending more time looking at my bird feeders these days working from home. And so if you do Cornell's feeder watch program, which is a formal survey, they ask you to do 2 hours a week. You do an hour of watching your feeders on two consecutive days every week. They're very conservative. It's like the most you see at one time. There's some other quirk of their methodology that I found very conservative, but it's not easy. And because the chickadees don't typically come all to your feeder at the same time, and they don't sit there. They make a quick hit, and then they're off. is so kinetic. And same with the nuthatches. Like, I don't know if I have two red-breasted nuthatches or eight, because they just sort of, they come and go. And I try to scan the surrounding trees to get a count. I mean, even bluebird. I have a bluebird flock that I know from going out there and watching them for a while that is almost a dozen. There's like 11 is the highest count I've gotten of bluebirds, and there's often a few pine warblers mixed in. But when they come to the feeders, you know, I'll sometimes only see four or five, and I'm sure the others are around, but I'm not getting that full count of 11. So you would think it would be easy, but counting birds at feeders is kind of a thinky thing, and it helps to get out and get a sense of what your total like local chickadee flock is, but you have to like. Sometimes you have to use tricks and bring them all in at once, you know, pish or imitate a screech owl or something like that. And that's why we do that on Christmas bird counts. Some people don't, but I think it's crazy not to. It's the only way to get good counts of birds is to, I mean, you can pish certainly if you're good at it, or you can imitate a screech owl, or you can play a little recording. Especially at these places you're only hitting once a year, and it brings everything in so you can count them. And I'm always astounded at how many birds there are. You go up to some thicket, or even if there's feeders around, and you would have guessed there were, you know, three chickadees and two cardinals, and then all of a sudden there's a dozen cardinals and a dozen chickadees coming into your pishing. So there are more birds than you think. Is the answer.
Jill has sent us a photo of a red-headed woodpecker. She says, I had this beauty at my feeder yesterday late morning. In the 34 years I've lived on Nantucket, I've only seen this special bird a few times. The first was right after my dad passed away, November 2019, right before Thanksgiving. Dad was a great carpenter, so it gave me comfort to have a visit from this handsome woodpecker in my backyard. Thank you for the bird report. Jill, thanks for sharing. That was
very nice.
That was very nice.
Red-bellied woodpecker, probably.
Red-bellied, yeah. Yes. I sent you the photo. You'd know better than I would.
Yeah. Well, red-headed is a rarity, but it's very, like, I do it sometimes. People say red-headed because the red-bellied woodpecker
has the
red
head. Yeah.
And birders, of course, are like, what? Wait, which? Are you sure? What do you mean? You know, because red-headed woodpecker.
Quick, I'll
really
be over.
Rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us a little about the rare pink-footed goose.
Yeah. So, that was on Thanksgiving. I got an email from one of our, I don't know if she's still current staff, Peggy Sagan, who's been a Mass Audubon staffer and volunteer for us, lives in Wellfleet. And she emailed me this photo. She's like, I think this is a pink-footed goose, just, you know, from their window. They live on a marsh in Wellfleet Harbor. And sure enough, it was a pink-footed goose, which is very, very rare. I got the word out, and I rarely chase anything anymore with two kids under three. But I grabbed Beckett, and we went out, and we went looking for it. And actually, nobody who went looking for it, and a lot of people did that morning around Wellfleet Harbor, none of us saw it. But it's, you know, that's not always the point. It's good to get out, talk to some other birders, you know, see people. And there were other good things around, like a flock of razorbills spitting distance from the L Pier in Wellfleet Harbor. But anyway, so you didn't hear anything, and no one ever refound that around Wellfleet Harbor. A couple days later, 3 days later, I was taking Beckett to a playground in Orleans, and I pull into a parking lot, and there's always a flock of geese at the Eldridge Park baseball field. And I was like, maybe it, and there it was. This very rare pink-footed goose was just standing there with the Canada geese on this baseball field. And so probably within 10 minutes of me, you know, getting the word out various ways, some of the local birders were on the scene photographing it. Probably 20 people saw it over the course of the next 2 hours. So this is a goose of breeds in like Greenland and Iceland and Arctic, Western Europe. And then pretty much all of them winter in the British Isles. And like a lot of geese, they take advantage of agricultural fields, and they'll eat old crops like the after they harvest the potatoes and the sugar beets, they go in and clean up the rest. And so their populations are increasing because of high winter survival, because of all this food they get in these agricultural fields. And that's happening with a lot of goose populations. It's actually causing problems. Here in our continent, it's snow geese, which is a rare bird here, but they go down and they winter in these rice fields and other agricultural complexes. And the southern states, they have really high winter survival. And then they're going back to the Arctic and denuding these kind of coastal tundra grasslands of vegetation because they're grazers. So there's some interesting things going on with geese. But as the pink-footed geese have been increasing in Greenland and Iceland, we're getting more and more records. There were no records for the Cape before 1999. It was one at Dennis Pine's golf course, I remember seeing back then. But now they're annual. So it's an interesting thing where this, you know, changes in the landscape use affecting goose populations in Europe and affecting what birds we see here on the Cape. So, yeah. As I say, it's a global world with birds.
Yeah, Dan says we should explain what fishing is. Fishing.
What do you mean?
You know, when you fishing, when you're fishing, when you're fishing. When you're doing the Christmas bird count.
Fishing. Yeah.
Fishing.
So fishing is the time-honored technique for bringing in small birds, getting their curiosity, making them think that something is amiss. So you're imitating some generic alarm call of a small bird, like a wren or a titmouse or something, where they kind of, when they're upset about something, like they're seeing an owl or a cat or something like that, they'll go and so if you make sounds like that, it gets the chickadees in, and then they start making noise, and then the other birds are responding to the chickadees, because lots of things are in these sort of loose, mixed flocks this time of year, even if it doesn't seem like it. They're sort of tracking each other. And so they're like, is there an owl? Is that an owl? And maybe there's an owl. We should go look. Let's go look.
We should find out. Yeah.
And then the birds come in. And it's amazing how well it works. Like I always say, you pull up to some frozen thicket, it literally looks like there's nothing alive, like nothing
right. Has
ever been alive in this thicket or ever will be again. And then you start pishing or you play the screech owl. And then there's 12 cardinals, 15 chickadees, 3 nuthatches, you know, a couple of pine warblers come in. It's just a fun thing to do on these Christmas counts. It's amazing what's out there when you bring things in.
Yeah, it's so true. So a caller says she saw a gull in Harwich with a hole in its upper breast, and she wondered if we had any thoughts on what that might be. Hard to say.
Hole in its upper breast?
Like, I'm wondering, does she mean like a little bullet hole? Or, yeah, she didn't, I guess, specify exactly what kind of hole it was, but I don't know.
Yeah, birds with holes in them, that doesn't sound great. Beyond
something bad happened, whatever it was, right? Something, but it wasn't good.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I would have to,
yeah.
Have to see
right,
that.
Let's talk to Becky, who's calling from Harwich. Hi, Becky.
Hi, and I'm getting off the subject of small birds, but they are birds. And 2 days ago on Sunday, I was walking in Chatham, and we were overlooking the Chatham Harbor, and there were hundreds, thousands of not just seagulls, but ducks and every kind of shorebird that I, you know, could imagine. And I'd never seen that before. I've been on the Cape for 40 years, and so I thought maybe I would ask that question. Why would there be so many gathered?
Which part of Chatham?
Thank you.
Becky, where in Chatham were you? I think Becky's gone.
No.
Oh, okay. Where were you in Chatham, right. Becky?
Looking down at the harbor, the Chatham Harbor.
At the harbor.
Chatham Harbor, like Aunt Lydia's Cove, the fish pier?
Yeah, it went all the way up to there, but it was right from the area that we were looking down on is right in front of the Chatham Coast Guard Station. And going up towards the fish pier, there were hundreds, thousands of birds, and it was not, well, it was a small craft warning. But nevertheless, I'd never seen so many birds in the harbor, ever.
Well, yeah, that's actually pretty typical for there. There might be, when you count the eiders and the gulls, like if you go to that vantage point or by the fish pier or, up by Strong Island, some of those, like the south end of Pleasant Bay, Chatham Harbor there, there might be 20,000 birds, and that's a fairly typical condition in the winter. Most of them are eiders and gulls, but there's lots of other things mixed in, buffaloheads and other sea ducks, but it's a very rich area. And eiders in particular, there might be 15,000 eiders there sometimes, more, kind of stretched out between the lighthouse and Strong Island. And it's really something to see. You can see it very well from Scattery Point, especially on certain tides. Yeah. And these giant rafts of eiders are just riding the current, feeding on blue mussels, diving, coming up with clumps of mussels, and then flying back to the head of the current. It's a very, very bird-rich area in the winter.
Hmm. Yeah. Becky, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Sure, thanks for the call. Karen in Wacoit sent a photo. She says, I had three common red poles at the top of an oak in my yard this morning. They appeared to be feeding on the buds. Karen, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, very nice. We didn't talk about winter finches again this month, but the winter finch invasion continues, and red poles have not been a huge component of it, or even a big component of it, but there have been a few around. I've still been getting siskins. I have 30 siskins to send on my feeders the other day. At the same time, all those bluebirds were there and pine warblers. It was really cool. So it just seems to be a really good year for feeder birds with all these winter finches around. And so still keep an eye out for evening grosbeaks and crossbills and things like that.
Yeah. So you want to talk a little about the novelty of having an actual North American native swan species around in the form of those tundra swans that are on Nantucket.
Yeah, I know. It is. That's why I wanted to talk about it, because it is such a novelty. Everyone's familiar with the mute swans, but to see a native North American swan in Massachusetts is very rare. They're kind of Arctic and subarctic nesting, these tundra swans, the middle of the continent up into Alaska, and they just don't come here. They winter in the mid-Atlantic, but for some reason they just don't tend to come to New England very often. And certainly not the Cape and Islands very often. But the tundra swan is a native North American swan, unlike the mute swans, which are imported from Europe. And there have been five for, a month or something like that on Nantucket. So it's just kind of a cool thing, and it's a rare opportunity to see one of our wild, wild American swans. The tundra swan. There's also there are a couple species in the hard to distinguish, but it tends to be the tundra swans. There's a trumpeter swan also, which if you've been to like Yellowstone, they're huge. You might see those there. But tundra swan tends to be of the two native North American species that very occasionally will show up in this area.
We're out of time, Mark. Second Tuesday of the month, Mark Faraday joins us with all the latest bird news. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you. See you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.